We were excited to hear that Bob Dylan received a Nobel Prize in Literature this week. So for our bonus weekend podcast, we're celebrating Dylan by featuring an interview with legendary documentarian D.A. Pennebaker. In 2015, Leonard spoke with Pennebaker about his groundbreaking documentary, Don't Look Back, a portrait of Bob Dylan in London during his 1965 tour, a turning point in his artistic career. Enjoy.
Although it's been 48 years since its original release, Don't Look Back, D.A. Pennebaker's chronicle of Bob Dylan's 1965 tour of England, still stands out as one of the most important pop music films ever made. And the version of Subterranean Homesick Blues, which we've been listening to, is presented in the film with Dylan dropping amusing cue cards as the song is played. It turns out that that would be recognized later as one of the first ever music videos to commemorate the 50th anniversary of that tour, his last solo acoustic tour. The Criterion Collection is re-releasing Don't Look Back on DVD and Blu-ray with digitally restored audio and video and a slew of special features, interviews, outtakes, and shorter documentaries. And I'm very pleased that all of that has brought D.A. Pennebaker back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you.
About that opening scene, the Subterranean Homesick Blues video with the cue cards, who came up with the idea?
That was Dylan's idea in a bar. And I'm he said to me, I guess he was meeting me as the filmmaker, right? Because Albert had arranged for me to be considered as a filmmaker
this
for the tour.
This is Albert Grossman.
And he said, do you think that's a good idea for a film? And I said, it's a fantastic idea. So we loaded up about 100 shirt cardboards and took them to London with us.
And then you shot three different versions of it.
Well, we did, but we didn't intend to have three. The first one was out in the garden behind the hotel, and a policeman came up and kept hitting me on the shoulder to stop doing it, and we finally had to stop doing it. And then we did the one version that we used. We did it in the alleyway behind the hotel because we knew there weren't be any cops there.
But also alleyways are in the lyric.
Right, that's right. And then we did one. Everybody was dressed up for something the next day, and they wanted to do another one with his producer. The guy was sleeping by the piano in the film. And we all got dressed up, and we went on the roof where it was very windy. And about halfway through it, I think the wind blew most of the cards away. So we only had one complete one.
You've said in interviews over the years that you don't make documentaries and that Don't Look Back isn't one. So how would you describe your films?
Well, I'm a little like Fred, I guess. I would tend to – Fred Wiseman – I'd call them movies only because that's what I grew up learning, looking at. And I think when you get too secular about it, if you start thinking that this kind is different from that kind, you get into trouble because people will always fool you and do something different.
But your films don't include narration, and you've been quoted as being against all the labels that are attributed to filmmakers like you. You said various people began calling our films direct cinema. Others called it cinema verite, but nobody really knew what to call them. Some even called it fly on the wall, but that wasn't right. At least I never wanted to be a fly on the wall. It's kind of a disgusting idea.
Yeah.
So it's just movie making?
Well, you know, what I really think it is, Leonard, is that what we have here is the beginning of a new language, which theoretically only children invent new language because their parents all have one already. And we're like children in the face of this technology, which allows us to practically speak, you know, and be heard. Well, it's like the whole thing that's coming out about particles, where you can have a particle two particles and you separate them by a million miles, and when you change one of them, it changes the other. So we're beginning to have a post-Einstein concept of what the world really is around us, and I think the need to tell people something is going to go beyond the just writing it out in a book.
So maybe you should call this quantum mechanics filmmaking.
Maybe. I don't know. Listen, when I use those words around my house, people start hitting me with brooms.
How much creative control were you given when you made arrangements to make it? You say it was...
Yeah. Albert just came.
Albert Grossman came
to you. He came in one time at lunchtime. Well, what happened was he came into our little office, which was on 43rd Street. We had Durst's building before he tore it down and built a new one. And Ricky Leacock, my partner, was there. And
you'd already made a number of films?
I had made, it's hard. I can't remember when I made films, but I definitely was not what I would call a well-known filmmaker at that point. And I had made a little short film with Duke Ellington done the music, and apparently Dylan had seen that film. I forget why. It's somebody had given it to him, but when he said, "I'd like to Ricky Leacock," he said, "Would you be interested in coming to London with my client, Bob Dylan, and making a film?" And Ricky said, "Who's Bob Dylan?" So he said, "Maybe I better wait for your partner."
Well, he was already well known, but still not the superstar.
He wasn't exactly. He had a song that was on the radio, and that's what I remember. The times, they are changing. But I didn't know much about him. And when Albert asked me, my immediate reaction was, I'd love to do films about musicians. And I had done a couple, and I thought maybe that was my calling, was to make films about musicians.
Now, this is about a 1965 tour of the UK.
Yeah.
But it wasn't released until 67. Was it difficult for you to find a distributor?
It was next to impossible.
Despite the fact that Dylan was already a well-known artist at the time?
Those things don't always move the way you would think. Fame is a peculiar bug, you know. It goes one direction and doesn't stop. I think what happened to me was that I had this film, which is shot on 16mm and black and white, which is, if you would mention this to anybody working in Hollywood, they giggle because it's ridiculous. Nobody would make a film on 16mm in black and white.
But you couldn't have shot this with the big 35mm cameras of the time.
Well, you couldn't have shot it. You couldn't shot anything, we thought, because you needed portability. You needed to be able to climb up on stage or go out in the desert. But also, you needed sync camera, and there was no sync camera. You needed to have dialogue. And we had Ricky and I and Al Mazels had kind of worked on making a camera that you could carry, you could put on your shoulder, and that would be sync. And we had made it, but it still was kind of ratty looking. There was no question in my mind. And I took it to some people who were, I thought, in my naive notion, I mean, I was an engineer. I graduated as an engineer from Yale, and I'd say I knew less about this business than anybody in the world. And when we talked to people, well, would you like to run this film in your theater? What we realized was the people running the theater didn't really decide which films they were going to run. That was decided by somebody out in Los Angeles. All they decided was how much ice cream and popcorn to get in here to make their rent. And so we couldn't find anybody to run it or any distributor for it. And a guy called up one day and said, I understand you have a film that I ought to look at. And I was ready to show it to anybody at that point. And so he came over and he looked at it. In the end, he said, it's exactly what I'm looking for. It looks like a porn film, and it's not. And it turns out he had this huge group of pornographic film theaters all over the West. And he said, I'm going to give you my best theater. It's in San Francisco. And which he did. And we had, I think we had a 16 print running there for almost a year.
And the title, Don't Look Back, works perfectly in a porn theater.
I know. That's right.
D.A. Pennybaker, we're talking about Don't Look Back, which Criterion has just reissued.
Oh, boy, they did such a great job. Criterion.
Some of these reissues, after they do all the work on them, the digital work, look better than the originals.
Oh, much better. Well, you've got to realize when we did it, I was taking a magazine which holds 400 feet of film. And you start out in the morning, a nice bright sunny morning, and you shoot everything at F64 or whatever it is. And then at night you go into rooms which are not very well lit, and if you don't have lighting, we never light anything. We just whatever is there is there, and that then you want to push that film, but it's the same roll of film, and you can only make it one speed. So we went to a lab in London, and they were terrific. They watched what they were doing somehow. I don't know how. And the result was the film is very unevenly exposed to be relatively clear to watch. And so we did the best we could when we made the 35 blow up. But it was at the time we weren't using Hollywood techniques. We were using people in New York who would do it. And I think when Criterion took it up, they took the went back to the original negative and re-timed everything, and then they went in the track, they went to the original quarter inch tracks that we had, and actually made as good an ending of it as you could possibly make. And I'm really grateful to them. And Kim Hendricks is probably the Hendrickson is the probably the person, along with Peter and the rest of the people over there, who really wanted to make the thing as good as they could.
Now, documentaries depend on what happens while they're being shot.
Yes.
And you really lucked out here. First of all, you can
say that about my life. I really lucked out.
Well, I guess serendipity is an important part.
It's essential to this kind of thing.
And in this case, you have Dylan becoming famous in England, having a real influence. He meets Donovan, who at that time was being accused of being a Dylan clone. You have the breakup of Dylan and Joan Baez as a couple.
Yeah.
And all sorts of other interesting – you catch some of these moments that perhaps Dylan wouldn't be all that happy knowing or going to wind up in a movie.
Well, it's interesting, people's reaction to themselves. I mean, it's the same with James Carville in The War Room. And he said, it's embarrassing, but I know that what you've shown is what really happened, and I can't go against it. And I think Dylan had somewhat the same attitude.
Now, we even have a scene where Dylan picks an argument with a reporter from Time magazine. He was distrustful of journalists?
Well, I knew that guy, and he later gave me the thing that he sent in. He gave me a copy of it. I still have it somewhere buried in a folder.
How well did you get to know Dylan at the time? Were you surprised? Because at this point, people thought he was very much at the left. Were you surprised when he wrote in Bob Dylan Chronicles, Volume 1, quote, I had a primitive way of looking at things, and I like country fair politics. My favorite politician was Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater.
Yeah. No,
Did you see that in him at the time?
Well, I wasn't looking for political anguish. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I started the film, I thought Albert has asked me to do this film because he wants a musical film to help promote his whatever he's going to do besides his concert stuff, and the records maybe whatever, and but about 3 days after I spent time with Bob, and especially in the hotel when the press people who had been who never knew who Dylan was at all were assigned to go get interview him, so they went having no idea who he was or what he was about, that I got intrigued by the way he used language, and I kind of a book that had always fascinated me long before I got into this was the book that was done in England about Byron and about his letters to and from Byron. And Byron, when he went to Pisa with Shelley, and all of the English intellectuals came down there to hang out. It was like San Francisco had turned into, you know, with all the hippies. And I thought, you know, if I'd been around then and made a film of Byron, people would still be looking at that film because he's still interesting to people. And I thought maybe that's the kind of film that's at stake here. And I shouldn't get involved with the music beyond hearing him sing. So I never had a complete song, I don't think.
Now, there are all sorts of extra features in this new box set from Criterion, including an interview with Patti Smith. How involved were you in putting those things together?
I didn't. They put that together out of the material. There's a lot of stuff. We shot a lot of things, and there's a wonderful thing of Marianne Faithfull singing with Joan. These are kind of things that were terrific, but the film I wanted to make, you got to understand, I made it in a viewer. I didn't even have an editing machine. And I did it very fast. I did it in 2 or 3 weeks. So I didn't spend a lot of time thinking all the other possibilities were there. I just wanted to see Dylan, the poet, trying to figure out if he was a poet.
And when it was released, it didn't receive a lot of positive press.
No, it didn't.
And now, of course, it's considered one of the great classics. And when you see other films that do something very similar, do you think, I influenced a whole generation or many generations of people who do these kinds of movies. I don't want to say documentaries because you don't like that word.
No, it's all right. It doesn't matter it's not for me to decide what to call them. People call them what the hell they want to call them, you know?
Well, I'm not going to call you a fly on the wall anyway.
No, that's all right. A bug on the wall.
And your films seem to go back and forth between music and politics. There was the War Room.
Some do.
What's it like watching Hillary Clinton's presidential run 20-plus years since you and Chris Hegedus made the War Room?
There's a film there. I mean, anybody who cares passionately about what they do and wants to do that as well as they can all their life, that's education for anybody that's watching.
And I understand you're making a film now about a lawyer who's defending the rights of chimpanzees.
Yes.
So we'll have you back when that film comes out?
When the chimpanzees are happy.
You're going to have to come here not only with the lawyer, but with one of the
chimpanzees. We wanted to bring one into the courtroom when we filmed there. But, you know, we knew we had a favorable courtroom at the Supreme Court here on Center Street when the judge in charge of the Holter allowed Chris, my partner, Chris Hegedus, to put a wireless mic on her. And I thought, I've never had a judge agree to do that. So she must want to be heard.
D.A. Pennebaker, his film Don't Look Back is about to celebrate it's celebrating its 48 years.
Is it 48 or 50?
Well, 50 years was a tour. 48 years was when the film came out.
I'm not too good on those dates, but I allow it. I look to you to figure the dates.
Available now in a new DVD and Blu-ray, digitally restored audio and video, and with special features, interviews, outtakes, and shorter documentaries from Criterion Collection. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate anybody who's interested in this kind of... in this kind of language, the language of filmmaking.